Well, my name is David Sylvester, and I was the director of the Schools Council project, History Project as it was called then, beginning in 1972.
Thank you. Could you tell me something about your own educational background and how you came into history teaching?
Well, I passed the 11 plus, went to Chesterfield Grammar School, which is Derbyshire. I was taught history by a man called T.E. Swain, we called him Tessie, and it was dictated notes and short factual information tests. But it got me to university and I went to Balliol College, Oxford. I remained keen on history, but while I was at school, I'd self-initiated a project on the Eyre Chapel, which was a Catholic chapel near Chesterfield where I lived. And thinking about the background, the influential books on me were Trevelyan's History of England in the 19th Century, and a man called J.M. Thompson, Lectures on Foreign History. I mean, those books have remained on my shelves and were very influential. And then degree studies. Well, studying sources, quite new to me, not my experience at school. Had to read Bede, de Tocqueville in the original, Stubbs Charters, medieval charters to 1307, and a special subject in using documents, which I did on Britain and India. I won a university prize. I didn't get a first, but I was still keen on history and I decided to teach. Though I did think of going into industry, as many of my contemporaries did, and they're now much richer than I am.
So what year was that?
Well, that would be 55. I went there in 52, graduated in 55. Stayed on 1 year, 56, to do the diploma in education. And I was keen on history. I read all the books available on the teaching of history. And they one in particular became influential, two actually. But the first one, I can't remember the exact author. I think it was by a man called Bell. But in discussing teaching, he emphasised that pupils should play an active part. And this interests me, because I remember him saying this: in classics, the pupils do the work. In history, the teacher does all the work, which was true, because I taught Latin later. You know, you got the boys to conjugate and do all the work in classics, but in history, you did it all. And that stuck with me. I thought, it can't be right. I'm going into teaching, I'm going to do all the work, and the pupil's going to do nothing. So that struck me. The second book, more important, was F.C. Happold, An Approach to the Teaching of History. It really did influence me. It's full of practical ideas, getting your pupils to do little man lectures, he called them, pupil projects, lots of things. So that was influential. And while I was still there, I had to read Newman's Idea of a University, which was new to me, but it certainly reinforced my belief in the importance of liberal education, which I'm afraid has stuck with me. You know, I'm going to quote a bit of it because I looked it up. A habit of mind is formed which lasts through life, of which the attributes are freedom, equitableness, calmness, moderation, and wisdom. A philosophical habit. So I always thought that, you know, learning to think was perhaps more important than anything, if we could do it. And then the other documents, book, I found in the library, as well as Keating, and that Bell book. You may be able to trace that Bell book. A History of England for Schools with Documents, Problems and Exercises by Keating, 1911. That really opened my eyes. Now, I did a practice term at Tunbridge School because, you know, I'd been in a state school, never been in a public school. It was new to me, but I enjoyed it. And then I went to the appointments board to discuss with the secretary, a man called Mr. Woolley, prospects for teaching. And this is very anecdotal, but it might be of interest to you. He said, "Well, Sylvester," and I remember this perfectly. He says, "Though you've been to Balliol, you're still the working class boy you were when you came up here." He said, "I'd never get you into Eton. I might get you a job at Wellington." But he said, "Take my advice, you've still got national service to do." He said, "Go in the army, get yourself in a good line regiment and get some class about you." Really shattered me. And what's worse, I said, "Oh, I've already agreed to go into the RAF." He said, "Oh my God. Well, come and see me in 2 years' time." And I always remember that. You did ask for that. National service, well, I went into the RAF, and ended up in the education branch, but that was 56 to 58. Getting the first teaching job, very interesting. I had an interview at Bishop Wordsworth School where Happold was headmaster. And William Golding was on the staff, actually. And I had an interview, and I didn't think I made a message, but at the end of it, he said, have you any questions? And I said, we've talked a lot about the teaching I'd do in the early years. Would there be any chance of sixth form teaching? He said, I'm not accustomed to young men asking me what their timetable is going to be. And he wrote to me a letter afterwards, and very nicely, and he said, though you were top of my list, in the end I've offered the job somewhere else. So I didn't go there, but I went to a small school called Wycliffe College, Stonehouse, Gloucestershire. Again, a boarding school, because I was quite keen on the other side of teaching, you know, sports. I was a good sportsman and all the rest of it. So I think I now come to your second question.
Yes, it was, what were the main influences on your approach as a teacher, although you've indicated some of them, haven't you? And how did your career develop?
Well, at Wycliffe I had a free hand, which was good. I was there for 3 years. I taught English, Latin, Divinity and History, but I got some sixth form work, encouraged by the head of department, whom I remember as Alan Johnson. And I practised Happold's approaches very much in teaching the junior forms. And in addition, something I don't think Happold put in, but I was very keen on, how to make notes. It's always been a thing of mine. At Chesterfield Grammar School, I'd learned the art of notation, and I've always said you must teach children how to make notes in history. It's no good writing long paragraphs. So, and I founded a Clio Society there, and we got even fellows from Oxford Colleges to come and talk to us there. But I hankered for more sixth form teaching, and in the end, I got a Scale B head of department job at Buxton College, which was a state grammar school. And then out of the blue, this is a skeleton in my cupboard, because out of the blue I got a call from a man called R.M.E. Pick, whom I'd met when I was at Stonehouse, Gloucestershire. I used to go to Cheltenham Historical Association branch, and he was head of history at St. Paul's College, Cheltenham, and I'd met him and got to know him. Anyway, he rang me up and he said, I've got to appoint a new lecturer, would you like to come here? I thought it was a chance to teach history at a higher level, and I took it. But it wasn't. When I got to Cheltenham, St. Paul's College, very ancient college, church college, teacher training, but the level of history teaching was less specialised than sixth form. But what I did begin to teach there was history method. That was one of my jobs there.
What years were you at St. Paul's then?
Well, I went to St. Paul's in 62 and I stayed there till 67 when I went to Leeds. But I started history teaching there and got, you know, read up all about these new methods like patch and line of development, which I'll come to. I did a bit of history. Cavendish House, which is a big store in Cheltenham, known by Fraser, I think, or Debenhams, asked me if I'd write a history of them, which I did. I went and looked at those documents, I did that. And then I'd got interested in ways of teaching history. I began a line of development book. Now, line of development, a man called M.V.C. Jeffries at Birmingham University had written a book on how you did it. You looked at a topic through time. And I decided I wanted to try this. So I produced a book called The Story of Medicine, which Arnold published in 1965. I have to admit that one of my interests in this was I'd had a long interest in going into medicine, which I hadn't done, because I got to the sixth form, got to Oxford, suddenly thought, influenced by a man called Schweitzer, whom you've probably heard of, I wanted to be a medic. And I remember going to see my head and he said, Sylvester, it's much better to do something about people's brains than their bones. Forget this medicine. Go off to Oxford and do your history. So I did. Anyway, the first book I wrote was The Story of Medicine. And I just want to, in case you don't find the book, it reveals my interest in method, because in the preface I put this. Often history books tell so much of kings and queens, of battles, politics and economics, that disease and medicine are left out of the picture. Yet disease is an inescapable part of human life. Animals have neither history nor medicine, and the story of medicine is peculiar to man. This book is written for young children to deepen their understanding of both history and medicine. It may be of interest to teachers since it presents a line of development approach to histories in schools. It should also help any of their school children who are studying some patch of history in detail. Now, patch was the other great thing of the time, which Marjorie Reeves had invented at Longmans and produced them their series books. Patches you did a period of time in detail. If you look at the book, it does include quotes from sources. Anyway, I was wanting more history. Saw this job, lecturing Department of Education, University of Leeds, to teach history method. And I got it. But I also taught history of education for higher degrees there. And I mean, in fact, I produced a book on Robert Lowe, which Cambridge University Press produced. And there's also a big book of mine called Educational Documents, 800 to 1816, which is still in print. But mainly, it was lectures on history method. And I prepare them, types of syllabus, approaches. I told the students about my magnetic board, and if you look in that book, there's my magnetic board, which I invented. I used to tell my students to use it. I never saw one do it, but I used to take it in schools and use it. It was a piece of metal, and with magnets and plastic, I could make battles, and Battle of the Nile, or things like that. And that's in the book. And then I produced with Gosden, who was my senior in the department. He was more interested in the history of education method, History for the Average Child, 1968. Now that came out at a time when the government was thinking of raising the school leaving age. And if you look at it, the chapters, most of the book's mine, chapters on local history, methods and materials are mine, including all the examples of children's work. And that's... Oh, the other teaching I'd done while I was at Leeds was I used to go a day a week into Cross Green Comprehensive School. Because, I mean, comprehensive schools were new. I think when I started teaching, there weren't any. And, of course, my experience hadn't been in them, but I wanted to get experience. So I used to go to Cross Green Comprehensive School, which was quite a tough one. And Alan Woppington was head of history there, and we taught together. And, in fact, he moved off a year before I did the project, and he went to Liverpool as the historian on the History, Geography, Social Studies project, which was founded by...
Stenhouse, was it?
No. What was his name? I've forgotten. But it was at Liverpool, that one. And it was 8 to 13.
Yeah.
What led... No, well, I'm on to your next chapter.
That's okay. I mean, the 8 to 13 one preceded schools.
Yes, it did.
But it was never as popular, was it?
Well, no, but it was part of that integrated movement that was happening in education at the time.
Yeah. So what led you to become involved with the proposed Schools Council project? Or was it the other way around, they got involved in your project?
No, I hadn't started the project. I was invited to do it. I think the prime mover to get a history project was a staff inspector in Her Majesty's Inspectorate, which was quite a powerful body in those days, called Mr. Wake, Roy Wake. And he was conscious that the Schools Council in the previous years had set up environmental studies projects, humanities projects, two geography projects, history, geography and social studies projects, not history on its own. So the directorship was advertised in the TES. I didn't respond. I thought, well, I'm interested, but I've got a family. Others did, and interviews, I understood, were held. It was only a two-year job, and funding was only agreed yearly, so I felt it's not for me. But anyway, they didn't appoint anybody, and then Mr. Joe Hunt, who was head of history at the City of London School here, got in touch with me, and I think he was chairman of the History Committee of the Schools Council. And he invited me to go and speak to them without commitment. He said, just come and tell us what you would do if you were given the chance. This was 1971, and I went. And I've kept notes of the points I made, as I'll repeat them to you. I said, well, the first thing I want to do, I want to explain to pupils what history was. Because I'd asked pupils in schools when I'd gone out on teaching practice, and you know, what do you think history is? Don't know, sir. They're very vague, and yet at the same time, every sociology book that you picked up, and sociology was growing in the schools, The first chapter always began defining sociology, saying what it did, what it could do, and children lapped onto it. I thought, they don't know what history is. So I said, if we had a project, the first thing I'd do is teach what history is. And I'd already explored it in that book, History for the Average Child. If you look on page 48, I've got a little thing on there, what is history, which had been in my mind. The second thing I said to this group was, and this goes back to my teacher training, pupils should do history, not receive it. Use sources, field work, participate in learning. And then I said, the third thing I want to do is, because we've got this raising the school leaving age, we want to relate the objectives of history to the needs of pupils. Try and show them that history will answer their needs. And I felt this was in contrast because there was a man called Coltraman, no, Coltram was a lady, Jeanette Coltram, Manchester
John
University.
Fines.
And Fines, yeah. And they produced a historical association pamphlet, which had defined objectives for history, but it had followed Bloom's taxonomy. Bloom was this American professor. But it had just too many objectives, 40 or 50, which they were claiming history could meet. And I was sceptical of this. I thought history might meet 4 or 5, but it couldn't eat 40 or 50. And then I said, well, of course, what we'd have to do is produce materials, if we want to do this, to show what our ideas are. And finally, I said, we need to write something, consider the place of history as a subject in the curriculum, because it was under attack. I mean, if you look at the journals of the day, Mary Price and all those people writing about it, you'll know about that. And the final thing, which was very unusual, I said, if I go for it, we'll have to produce an O-level exam, because I said, I don't think any history teacher worth his salt is going to take on new ideas if his children can't get an O-level out of it. That was a strong insistence of mine. Well, I was offered the job. I was very uncertain about to take it, particularly because my professor, Professor Walsh, said I'd have to give up my lectureship if I wanted to do anything with the Schools Council. The Schools Council wasn't really popular with some conservative educationists at the time. He wouldn't second me. So I wrote back to the Schools Council and said, I'm not sure I'd do it. So Roy Wake, who came up to Leeds and to see me, and he persuaded me. Well, I accepted it, and I really must say, I found it the most rewarding things I've ever done. I really enjoyed it.
They'd actually headhunted you, haven't they?
Yes.
Because you'd written the book.
Yes. And I was giving talks around the place, and so, yes, they headhunted me. I don't know who they interviewed. I think I know there was a man at Goole who'd written a book who did want the job, and Goole Grammar School, I forgot his name. But anyway, they asked me, and I took it. So I think I'm on to your fourth question now.
I just wanted to ask you about the ideas that Roy Wake and Mr. Hunt had. Do you think that they already had ideas which coincided with yours?
I think they wanted to establish history as a subject back in the curriculum. They were very worried about the growth of humanities and integrated studies. And I mean, Roy Wake is staff inspector for history, you know, that's his job. To represent history in the curriculum, and that was his motive. And of course, Joe Hunt was a keen historian. Yes,
but they saw your ideas as being attractive, as something that teachers would want to take up.
Well, I think they must have done. Yes, they must have done.
So, in making that sort of new rationale for history, that you were stating it met all these needs and that it had a purpose, perhaps different to it had never been articulated before.
No, it hadn't, and I mean, I'll say that. Well, you're perhaps anticipating your next question, because...
Yes, the philosophy. So where did the key ideas come from which informed the project?
Well, this may sound arrogant, but the ideas were mine. I mean, the team in discussion helped to develop the topics and certainly helped to develop materials. But initially, when I met the team, I mean, in the interview I indicated what things we were doing, but in the early meetings, I expounded what I wanted to do. And some of the team were a bit resistant because with all the pressure on raising the school leaving age, some of the team, there were three of us, Well, I've explained to you, but perhaps I'll explain to others. One was a young teacher, the other was a head of department, and the third man had been a colonel in the Army Education Corps. But they were suggesting that the history had got to be made practical for these pupils. And I was under strong pressure to get pupils to make models. We'd produce materials to enable them to make models of castles and things. And I resisted this. I said, no, we're not going that way. My view is not that history, I don't think it couldn't be, I'm not saying it couldn't be useful, but I certainly don't want it vocational. So I took that idea that we should develop some uses for it, but not practical skills. So I expand my ideas, which I'll come on to because you've asked me about the principles. The consultative committee were very helpful in forwarding my ideas, I have to say that. But not in setting them up. That came much later, I think. They weren't there, the ideas, you know. They supported them, but they didn't actually work out what we were going to do. So in no sense, I think, did the project come from elsewhere. And I'd like to say this, certainly, it's unusual from all the other curriculum projects at the time, because it was a great age of curriculum development. Most of the other projects had come from the universities. Schools maths projects, professors were behind it. Geography projects, professors behind them. Nuffield Science, professors behind it. History, most of them were sceptical. The only history professors I could recruit were the ones at Leeds, and there was a man called Taylor, who was very helpful. He was head of School of History. It wasn't AJP Taylor, it was a man called Arthur Taylor. And he was helpful, but generally, I mean, people were against it, a lot of people were against it. Now, the principles were those that I outlined. You asked me about the principles. Well, they were exactly those I'd outlined to the school's council to establish history as a subject. And so the first thing we did, we got a What is History course going and produced those materials. Then we had objectives in terms of needs of pupils. And we'd only gone a few weeks when we were doing this, when Stenhouse, Lawrence Stenhouse, who was a big figure in curriculum development and director of the Humanities Project at University of East Anglia, wrote to me and said, would I go and see him? And he tried to persuade me to move the project to UEA. He said, look, I've got marvellous rooms here, you'll get all my support, all my experience. But he and I clashed on this needs business. He said he thought it was arrogant to think that I knew what needs pupils had. So we clashed on that. And anyway, Roy Wakes came to me and he said, you mustn't move to Stenhouse. He's a powerful figure. He'll dominate you. You'll lose all your ideas. And so don't go. So I didn't. The exam syllabus, I was very keen on, because I thought no serious secondary teacher would take it up. And then we produce books and materials. But you ask about the interval of the principles behind this. Behind all this, I now knew, I got a lot of my ideas from reading Collingwood, the philosopher, where he said history is rethinking the thoughts of the past. Actively you rethink them. And it invokes empathy, a word I brought into history teaching which caused me a lot of trouble, but nevertheless, it came into the words and it's been around in history teaching for a while. I read his autobiography, Collingwood's, and his idea of history, and they did influence me. And the other thing that I wanted to emphasise was that history was not a structured body of knowledge, I was trying to develop this, which could be taught through dates and lists of causes and consequences. Now, many teachers thought it was and opposed it. I remember people like, when I went to give talks, the teacher at what's the big grammar school in Oxford, Magdalen College School, yeah, thought I was completely wrong. But I did develop a visual aid, and which I want to explain to you because it may have disappeared. I developed the view that history was a heap of materials which survive from the past and which historians can use as evidence of the past. And this heap, they either tunnel down into it like a line of development, or they go in from the side like a patch and do the Tudors, or they cut off the top and do contemporary history, or they go in a little spot and they do local history. And I had this, you can look at my visual aid if you like, there's a timeline, and there's a heap of resources, and people either go in at the top or they go in at the bottom or anywhere around. And we produce this visually, and I used to carry it around and go off lectures and put it up on the board. And we actually made a film. Now, if you can get over the film, I don't know whether the film's disappeared. Trinity North Sense might have a copy. But that visual aid figured a lot in that.
Do you know the title of the film?
Well, it was called History 13 to 16. I mean, it was made locally by Leeds. There was a man called Proney who was very keen on film in history, and Leeds had a good film department who did it for us. I'm sorry, I can't be more helpful on that. Now, I think probably we've come to your fifth question.
I'd love to ask you what factors influence the choice of topics that you put on the syllabus.
Yes.
And were any topics deemed too controversial?
Well, the first thing is the constraint of 13 to 16 was a constraint in the choice of topics, because, I mean, I would have preferred to start at 11 and develop a syllabus up to 16, a secondary syllabus as a whole, but we couldn't do that because the Schools Council had already funded the 8 to 13 history geography project, so we'd lost all that. So I said, well, at least if we start at 13, we must make sure that we know what history is then. So what is history? The first materials we produced were produced for 13-year-olds. Though later it got moved back by teachers to 11, even 7. Now, my idea of detective work, it was my idea, I had this idea that if we had a wallet and we found some documents in it, we could get children to discover who this person was. And it was based on, my idea was Richard Hillary. I don't know if you know his book. He was a Battle of Britain pilot called The Last Enemy, Richard Hillary. And he was famous because he wrote this book, and then he was burnt terribly in an accident, and Mackindo, the famous surgeon, worked on him. Anyway, I thought Hillary would be the perfect, exciting Battle of Britain pilot. Aileen Plummer and I, who was one of the team, we went off to see his father in London to ask him if we could, what we would plan to do. And the idea is that it was the documents found on the body of an injured pilot. He was quite sympathetic, though a bit bemused by it. But in the end, we couldn't get enough evidence about Richard Hillary. And so we made up a person called Mark Pullen. And we actually made him up, and it was probably as well we didn't get into any problems with litigation, you know, of real people. We made him up, though the sources were true, in the sense that they were real documents that had come from students' pockets. He was a student at a university, and we got actual documents of student union cards and things, and that's what were in the pack. And that was the first thing we developed. Then we got to these problems of evidence, which we wanted to develop as part of the What is History pack. There were problems with this. Pressure, I wasn't that keen on Richard III, but the team were. And we decided to do Richard III. And we nearly got into a mess with it, because a lecturer at Jordan Hill, a man called Ducky McIntyre, got the law onto us and said we'd pinched all his ideas. And I had a call from the Schools Council saying, you know, what's all this? Anyway, it was fortunate that I could point to that book I'd written, History for the Average Child, especially Chapter 5, because it tells there these ideas about problems of evidence. So we got off that. But on reflection, I wish we hadn't done Richard III. He's been overworked. But anyway, we developed that. And we did other problems like, well, you know what they are, the Derby Day and things like that. But then the 14 to 16 syllabus, which is a team we developed. I mean, I may have had the idea that we needed one, but the team certainly developed it. Except the medicine came from me. But one or two of them said, you know, that's your pigeon. So I said, right, we'll do some consumer research. So we circulated all the, we got 50 to 60 pilot schools, and we circulated all the schools and said, if you had to do a development study, what would you want to do? Costume, weapons, war. And medicine came out top, so I was relieved about that. We got onto it, but we certainly tried other topics. And then the other periods, whether we did Elizabeth and the West, they strongly came from two of the team members, and so we developed those. Contemporary world studies we did as a group, and I'm on reflection, I think it's very interesting. We came up with four topics which are still with us: Arab-Israeli, Ireland, Europe, and China. We thought of South Africa, and that was a topic for later, but they were all contemporary problems. And many historians thought at the time, you shouldn't be getting children to think about contemporary history like that. History around us was developed as a team, and the topics were agreed easily. If you want to see what options we discussed, they're in a New Look at History, page 30, I think, or 20. And I think that brings me to your sixth question.
Did the pilot phase go as planned, or were changes made after the trial schools tried the approach and materials?
Well, the pilot phase depended on the dissemination of ideas, whether we could get them across. And if history is about ideas, as I got strongly from Collingwood, then I took the view that we got to discuss them. And so discussion became our main method of dissemination. We had, the moment we got these teachers, we put them into groups, local area groups, and each of us visited a group, and we discussed our ideas with them, got feedback, and that came back to what we were doing. And I went and gave talks throughout the country, all over the place, history teachers. There were lots of history teacher groups at the time, and I even went to Scotland, I even went to the United States, but that's indifferent. And then we produced this film, which featured my ideas, and usually it only went out with either me to speak to it or one of the members. But eventually we allowed teachers' organisations to borrow it without a speaker, and it went out a lot. Advisors used to borrow it too. The trial schools were divided into groups, and they had regular meetings with team members who would discuss trial materials. And then we had conferences, which we paid for from the budget. We got trial teachers to come to Leeds, we put them in halls of residence in the vacation, and they helped, they discussed, and they helped us produce the materials. They were very helpful. Mainly the materials on the modern world studies, but that's what they helped with. One or two trial schools dropped out, but others joined, and we didn't really have any problem with that.
Did you limit the number of schools who could be in the pilot?
No, we didn't really, because we could give the materials freely at that stage. I think there came a problem later when they had to buy them from Holmes McDougall. Talking about trial schools, I think it's very interesting. We had a group from Northern Ireland, very strong, who came to the conferences. I mean, some of the leaders were nuns from, you know, Belfast. Very strong supporters from Northern Ireland. The materials were changed from pilot to publication by Holmes McDougall.
What year was that, do you know?
It was before I left, so we got them very quickly. We were getting materials out in 74. We'd had a man called Colin Tyson, who was lecturing in education at Leeds in history. He got me a local printer there who printed all our pilot materials, and that was very helpful. And then we got Holmes McDougall, mainly through the school's council. I'd wanted long ones, because they were the great history publishers. But school's council had given every other project to long ones, and I think they felt guilty, and so they gave it to Holmes McDougall. But Holmes McDougall were very helpful in the end. But they perhaps didn't have the advertising, and being in Scotland, didn't have the advertising network that long ones did.
Did you have to make many changes to the materials?
No, because we'd had teachers look at them and play with them, either in groups or when they'd come on the conference at Leeds. No, we didn't have to change them much. No, we didn't.
So what challenges faced the project team in setting O-level and CSE exams in the early stages? How were assessment criteria developed, and what were the differences between the two types of SCHP exam?
Well, as I've indicated before, it's important to know that until then, no project had produced an exam syllabus, not Nuffield Science or the maths project. So it was unusual. It was new ground. And when we approached the boards, they were reluctant, except one, the CESD board in the south, where a very energetic, innovative man called Henry McIntosh was secretary. And he was lively and interested. He came to see us. He wanted to do it. His own board had been very, innovative. I can't say the word. At CSE level, so he was interested. And he came along straight away when I got in touch with him and said, yes, whatever you want to do, we'll make an exam. And he helped us a lot in producing exam papers because he was keen on objectives and the way he did it. O-level board, difficult. Could we find one? No. And the only reason we found one is, again, my background. I've been senior examiner in A-level history for the Southern Universities Joint Board for some years. So I knew the secretary there, but he was a very conservative man. But they agreed to do it with some reluctance. And they nearly pulled out later, just as I was leaving the project. And I think the O-level board only stayed with it with some reluctance because a man called John Slater, who by that time had succeeded Roy Wake as senior HMI, got them to continue it. But there was a real problem getting an O-level board.
Why did they feel so reluctant, do you think? They thought they might lose the market?
Well, no O-level board had thought about using documents. This was a worry. I mean, after all, 90% of teachers found this very hard to stomach. You were used to giving notes to children and giving them facts, and they got good O-level results. And a lot of my colleagues in history method departments up and down the country were against it. I mean, particular, because I talked to them, Burston, who was the great guru at the University Institute of Education, was very antipathetic.
On the basis that they wouldn't be able to cope with them?
Well, on the basis that, as Altman had written in an article in 70, sources are for adults at university, they're not for children. My view was, well, if sources are the basis of history, we're not teaching history, I don't know what we're teaching. That was my point of view. And that's why the next thing that was a challenge, which came in, I wanted to produce an unseen paper. This really was difficult. I mean, I even had trouble with my own team on this. But it was the view that if you've taught children skills, then they ought to be able to do them unseen. You know, if you've taught them French, they can do it unseen. If you've taught them history skills, you give them a history problem, the historical problem with which they don't know all the background, but they can still say, well, I think that evidence is suspect. Anyway, that was my idea. And we worked on it a lot, the team did, and we produced one, and you can see examples of them. They were produced in the early years. They were eventually dropped by the project because I think teachers didn't like them. They felt that wasn't real history, and they may be right, I don't know.
I wonder if they felt it was unpredictable, the outcome.
I think they felt that, and they also felt that even in history, even when a historian approaches sources, he's got some general background of it. He never comes completely new to a problem. He knows a bit about the Tudors before he does something on Cromwell or whatever. But the interesting thing is that the SREB and Oxford local exam boards had tried a documents paper, but they'd stopped it in the early 70s because they felt it was too much for pupils who were doing no more than comprehension on them. They weren't really using historical skills. So there was a body of opinion against them. But anyway, we went ahead. I felt that our things on the nature and use of evidence was different. And we valued it at 30% of the total mark, which was a high valuation. It disappeared. I don't know when. The boards will tell you. But I always felt it was regrettable it went, because in a way that encapsulated some of our ideas. But the other thing we brought in, and you asked me what factors made for difficulty, we brought in coursework as part of final assessment. Now, you may find this hard to believe, but this was new to the exam system.
In any subject?
No coursework was around. There were some CSE boards which allowed personal topics to be submitted, but not actual coursework. We thought it was obviously the best way to assess our history around course, because that was field work. We weren't so sure about the other areas. Well, I wasn't, but the team overruled me on that, I must admit. But anyway, we went ahead with coursework, and I think we overvalued it. I mean, these young teachers who were with me on my team, they gave it 40%. And as we've since found with the exam system, coursework is open to abuse, and I think we got it wrong. I cannot recollect the differences between the two exams, CSE and O-level. There probably were some. I think there were certainly some in the way the papers were set. You have asked me about this, but I can't recollect the details. I haven't got the papers in front of me. So I think I've got to move you on to your eighth question.
What features of SCHP attracted the schools who joined in the first phase? And were there any problems or difficulties which they highlighted in delivering the course? And what sort of training did you provide when they were switching from traditional to these new methods? Did you show them how to use materials and what tell them?
Well, that's a very perceptive question, because it raises quite a few issues. First is, the What Is History was very attractive. That really did attract people. Even if they didn't want the rest of the syllabus, the What Is History went into so many schools, and very soon other publishers had got their own What Is History courses out. Or textbooks were beginning with a page on What Is History. So it became very attractive throughout the profession. The syllabus attractive to some because of the forthcoming raising of the school leaving age and reorganisations going on in schools at 13 and so on, when you left middle schools. So that was attractive. But the problems were highlighted by the start at 13. You know, many wanted to use What Is History at 11. And so it raised the problem, well then, what do you do between 11 and 13 when your syllabus starts? And we had discussions and we suggested teachers, but we felt that we couldn't be prescriptive because the school's council had already got other projects. But we did suggest that if they put the What Is History in at 11, and it was just feasible at 11, it wasn't too difficult for year 11 pupils, though it did need some amendment, then they could create their own syllabus for years 2 and 3 based on lines of development or patch studies or local history. That's what we used to say. A real difficulty was cost. I mean, it was £1,000 to £2,000 to introducing it into a school. That's a lot of money.
So the materials from Holmes & Doodle, that was the main cost.
Yeah. And, you know, to say, well, I'm going up to 16, some schools found it difficult. I think one or two may have chickened out and just left it at What Is History for that reason. Training, well, I think you've got to remember this, all teachers were shifting from traditional methods. There weren't many teachers out there who were doing what we were suggesting. So we did training in trial groups with team members and discussion. And the emphasis was on discussion with teachers, and the other emphasis that they got to discuss it with pupils. It's no good handing out What Is History and saying, get on with it, like the average history teacher used to do, hand out the textbooks. You've got to discuss it with them. And some did. I mean, we went to schools, and that Mark Pullen exercise, which is the wallet one, they just handed it out and said to the youngsters, get on with it. They didn't say, now, this is what we're trying to do. This is what you've got to look through the documents, see if you can work this out. No discussion. But the emphasis on discussion was what we pressed for. And I don't think I can reflect on that anymore.
Did you have any way of, if you like, checking how people actually used?
No, we didn't. Except that sometimes when my team members went off and watched lessons in class, which we did, they said, oh, it was terrible there. Miss so-and-so just handed them out. And then they'd talk to the teacher afterwards and say not afterwards. But, I mean, we were a limited group to see how we could train the whole teacher. There were only 3 of us, 4 of us. So, anyway, but we did try, and that was the point. discussion.
Did you have teachers' books or guidebooks of any sort, or was it all done through just the group meetings?
I can't remember. I think we must have had sheets, teachers' guidelines. Yes, we did. Whether they're still in the archive, I don't know. I didn't keep any. I think we must have done. Yes. Yes. But of course, we tried to make the instructions. When you get textbooks which have sources in them, then you can guide your teacher a lot. As you know now, the teachers guide the source questions on the sources. Look at this source. Look at sources A and B. What does this tell you? What's the difference between A and B? I mean, you can guide the teachers through the sources. So at least we could do it when we got to source work.
So how was the project promoted in the 70s and 80s? And was there a worry that too many schools would take it on without subscribing to the philosophy? And were there any criticisms from traditionalists?
Yes. Well, I can only speak for the early 70s because I left the project, and I'll tell you about that later. Well, we promoted it by talks, and our team went, and we loaned the film, and the materials became the message in a way, and was that famous, you know, Professor McLuhan, wasn't it? McLuhan idea, the media is the message, which was going around at the time, and I suppose in a way our materials were our message. We felt that we got good materials, and that was our way of doing it. But there was a worry that the materials were not the message, and in particular the teachers just handed them out, didn't get pupils to discuss evidence or interpretations. That was a worry. There's no doubt about that, and we knew it was happening. There was much criticism from traditionalists. I mean, I've mentioned Burston at London Institute, Batho at Sheffield, professor of history, and my own colleagues at University of Leeds were very lukewarm. I think I brought the article by Batho to tell you about it, but I mean, he wrote a book on the history of teaching up to 86 and never mentioned the project, you know what I mean? And of course, G.R. Elton's article of 1970 was put in a book by New Movements in the Study and Teaching of History. That was very anti the idea. And Batho's article got out in a book, The Development of the Secondary Curriculum, by Price, as late as 1986, didn't mention the project. The other people were a bit lukewarm, but prohibit, but they're interesting criticisms, which I want to mention. Carol Adams, who was at, I think she was teacher's wardens at ILIA. ILIA had a history and social sciences teacher's centre. I mean, I went to talk to them and met them, but she became a bit critical and publicised it in Teaching History in June 1983. I'll give you the reference, 36. Because it didn't include women's studies, and we were, but it wasn't that we didn't know, but I mean, the whole country hadn't got to women's studies then, if you think about the 1970s, so I felt that perhaps we'd been criticised a little early for that. And then the same journal, Clio, in a journal of the ILIA History and Social Sciences Centre, volume 6, number 1, it had been on the tape, 1986, by Nigel Fyle, criticised us for not tackling racism. Well, these were, you know, 10 years later than when the project had been set up, and I think, though they're valid criticisms, those were criticisms that necessarily had to come later. I'd certainly hoped to influence schools widely, and I'd hoped to resurrect its study in primary schools, because I knew it had disappeared in primary schools where topic work prevailed. And it did have some influence. Other boards were influenced. I don't know whether you know an article by John Bald in the TES, 1862, but I think I've brought a copy of that if you haven't. But that tells how other boards did get influenced by it. My final reflection on this is, did the universities change? I don't know whether universities were doing, I mean, some universities were doing special topics where students in history had to look at sources. But I was intrigued to find at Leeds in 1996, the single honours course in history, level 2 module was, I quote, historical skills and documentary study, which I thought was interesting. Because certainly before then, some university professors, though they'd used documents, I don't think they'd seen it as part of something that they'd make as as clear-cut as that is to examine. And I think I've moved on now.
I was going to ask you how the first evaluation by Dennis Shevell came about, and were there any surprises in its outcomes, and how did the evaluation influence the development of the project?
Yes. Well, I wanted proof that the project had an effect on children's thinking. I mean, at the time, there was a famous education psychologist called Bruner, American, and he had a view which influenced me, that any subject can be taught effectively, I'm quoting, in some intellectually honest form to any child at any stage of development. That's in Bruner, The Process of Education, 1960. And it had stuck with me that, you know, history you could teach to any child at any stage of development. You didn't have to pretend it wasn't history. Well, in 73, soon after we started, I requested extra funding from the Schools Council to get this evaluation. Now, the current fashion at the time and in the Schools Council was for a thing called illuminative, I need to quote this, it's in quotes, illuminative evaluation. It had been developed by Stenhouse at the Humanities Project by a man called Barry MacDonald, who was his senior evaluator, and it had been adopted by other Schools Council projects. It was the prevailing view of how you did evaluation. And you sent an evaluator in, and he watched, and he made notes, and he talked, and he didn't record anything, and he didn't test. It was an illuminative evaluation. It was a discussion. Well, I wanted something harder. I thought, surely we can get something statistical, something more psychological. Because I knew that psychologists could test whether children could achieve mathematical skills. And that's what I wanted. Now, the rest of the team were not with me on this. But I was the boss, so I stuck out on it. And I looked for someone who had got this statistical experience for evaluation. And I had to find it in Leeds. There was a man called Dennis Shemmel, a young man just finishing off a sociological, statistical piece of research at the Institute of Education where I was. And I appointed him. It was a long shot, I admit. He had no history, never done history. I used to give him tutorials on it, but I subsequently left. This led to one of my team leaving, because they felt that, one of them felt that the illuminative evaluation was the right method, not this testing stuff. So I lost one team member. But Shemmel was a sociologist, completely ignorant of history. I gave him tutorials to get him into our philosophy. I got him to read Collingwood. And in particular, his brief was to evaluate the project in relation to Piagetian thinking. I mean, my hope being that the teaching in the trial schools would show that pupils, before the age of 16, could think at the formal operational level. I should explain, Piaget has this view that some children can operate at the formal operational level, other children can only operate at the concrete operational level. Now, in maths, many children could work at the formal operational level at 16. In history, most children never got beyond the concrete level. And I knew all this because at Leeds University, there was a professor who was supervising all this work on Piaget. And he had a student called Hallam, who was at St. John's College, York, who'd done research into this, and he'd concluded, he'd written it in articles, that the formal operational thinking in history pre-16 was not possible. Possible in maths, not in history. So that's what the literature said. The professor was a man called Lovell. He was a mathematician. And I mean, I used to meet him over coffee. Early on, he said to me, it stuck in my memory, "You're the young man," I was a young man, he said, "You're the young man who thinks he can teach ploughboys to think, are you?" And I said, "Well, I'm hoping so." He said, "It won't happen." So that was his view, and that was the view of the strong Piagetians. The more general objective of the evaluation was to see how if children could work with sources. And what were the outcomes? Well, it was true. Only the most able could operate at the formal operational level in history. But they could. Some could. It was a little disappointing, but some could. On the other issue of sources, all children could work with sources if they were edited and perhaps changed in the language a bit. And that was quite pleasing. They could be motivated to learn and enjoy history as young as 11 by looking at bits of Doomsday Book or things like that. And certainly they could begin to discuss concepts orally, with success, if the teachers got the discussion methods right. Again, what did it show? It showed that the ability to write acceptable English about concepts was not well developed in many pupils, but then that would be true of many in other subjects writing at that level. I can't comment on what happened in the 80s, though work on the use of computers began, and I think it did change methods in the schools. So I think that probably brings me on to 11.
Mm-hmm. Would you agree that SCHP had a critical influence on GCSE?
Well, I think it did. I mean, because you only have to look at the GCSE criteria set up in 1985 that it reflected the they now call it the SCHP's objectives. Well, why? Well, I think we had the support of the Historical Association. We had the support of the History HMI, and they were very influential on GCSE criteria. We had the support of advisors and examiners working on other boards, Cambridge Board particularly, and the AEB particularly, very much for it. Many teacher training colleges, the historians were keen on it and supported it. And so I think the influence of the profession of young teachers who went in, and you began to see adverts in the TES wanted teacher interest in SHP to come, so it got going.
And that presumably was a product of teachers just feeling it was enjoyable.
Yes, and it was new light on history, and many of them saw that history, I mean, sources were the basis of history, so why not try and teach it? But I want to relate here a story which is anecdotal, but I think it's significant because I by then had joined Her Majesty's Inspectorate. The reason I joined is I'd lost my job, really. You know, the lectureship wouldn't have continued. And the funding was only every 3 years, and they'd only fund it one extra year, and I got a family. And I was looking for a job, and fortunately a job came up in the Inspectorate.
What year was that?
Well, the job came up in 1974, and that's when I went for it, and I said, but I don't want to leave the project. I got it. I don't want to leave the project. I said to the inspector, can I stay another year? So I didn't leave till 75 and went into the inspectorate then. But once I got into the inspectorate, I became one of, there were only about 7 or 8 history HMI. This is anecdotal, but it struck me, none of whom had ever taught in a state school. I was the first who had. And mine had been in a grammar school with a bit of part-time experience in a comprehensive. Anyway, as an inspector, I was working on things called the Red Books in the inspectorate and with advisors. And we had a meeting, I remember, in Nottingham in the CEO's office. And he suddenly turned to Roy Wake, who was still the senior history man. Where is there good history teaching in England? He said, Eton. And I said, you must be joking, Roy. He said, no, have you ever been? I said, no, I'll take you. He did, he took me. I went in 1983, and I went to some lessons, as inspectors did, they sit in lessons. And I had lunch with all the history staff, and I raised to them, it was a very amicable statement, and of course they're very civilised people, and I raised to them a question. I said, I notice you don't use sources in your history teaching. I mean, I'd seen one lesson which was exactly as I'd been taught in 1950, a young man in a gown dictating notes. Anyway, they said, no, that's for university students. Only university. I said, well, it's interesting that you think not many of us go to university. And certainly not everybody goes to university to do history, which means it's a very small percentage of the population who ever know that history is about sources. I said, I think it's going to come, you see. So there was a young teacher there. He said, well, I've just come from a comprehensive school in London. And he said, they've got a thing called the School's History Project there. He said, and we've used sources, and they seem to get on with it. I didn't declare my interest. I kept my anonymity there. So then one of the staff, I said, well, I think it's going to come, because I said, we're already working on GCSE criteria, 83. I said, I think you'll find when the criteria come out for GCSE, in every subject's going to have criteria, and the history criteria will say some work on evidence, some work on sources. So at this, one of the members of staff, who I subsequently discovered was a fellow of All Souls, said, well, Mr. Sylvester, I have to say to you that I had dinner with the PM last weekend, the PM being Thatcher, and she assured me that schools like it, well, public schools will still do O-level, and it's the other schools that will do GCSE. So I said, well, you may be right, but we'll have to wait and see. And that's how I ended, except I saw the headmaster afterwards, who was very pleasant, but he said, Mr. Sylvester, he said, I think I'd back my fellow of All Souls against you any day on this issue. I said, well, we'll wait and see. We did. And GCSE brought it in, and it's meant that all children who do history now do work on it. So it obviously has influenced the system. Mm. Now, what was 13?
Well, whereas in the 70s, SCHP was regarded as novel and radical, some people would argue it's become mainstream in GCSE national curriculum. So what's your view on that?
I think it has. I think it's had a major influence. And it's mainstream. I think it's only a third of the people who do the syllabus. The syllabus hasn't overtaken the world, but I think the whole system, all history papers you look at now have work on sources. So in that sense, though the syllabus hasn't, the method has, which is really what I was hoped for initially. And I think it's only worked because we got the exam system. I mean, I'm convinced about this. If we hadn't got the exam boards with us to take it on, the teacher profession wouldn't change, because most teachers do have to get their children an O level or a GCSE. So it's the exam that counts still, and must do. I think that brings me to 13, doesn't it?
I haven't got a question
for you. Oh, well, it's me. Do you mind if I add it?
Not at all.
Other developments in the teaching of history. Because you may not, I know you're doing research on the teaching of history, you may or may not be aware of them. But there was one thing that I happened to do as an HMI. I developed in 1976 and used on courses a thing called Objectives for Pupils' Progress in History. If you want to see it, it'll come out, but it's in Teaching History, number 26, 1980, pages 29 to 30. And it's also printed in History in the Primary Years, Secondary Years, HMSO, 1985, pages 18 to 19. But I worked on this on my own, and I suppose I'm quite proud of it. It's a sheet of history skills from 5 to 16, what you can get a 5-year-old to do and what you can get a 16-year-old to do in all the various areas of skills. And I think that influence, because we used to go away on courses and my colleagues and I used it a lot, well, for 15 years, it influenced primary as well as secondary history. And I'm saying it, but it's one of the best things I did, I think. I think the other developments were the role of HMI. There was a man called John Slater who succeeded Wake, and he was very influential in pressing these ideas. I mean, if you look at, there's a Curriculum Matters, the HMI produced books called Curriculum Matters, History 5 to 16, he was very influential in that. I mean, DES booklets never declare authors, but I was either editor or secretary of some, and if you look at Curriculum 11 to 16, the red books, that was part of the work. And I want to particularly mention, I know time's running out, A View of the Curriculum, which I was an editor to in 1980, which even suggests, Proposition 11, suggests that history should be taught to all pupils up to the age of 16. It was a government, it was a HMI proposition. It was never accepted by politicians, but it was there in 1980. I think the curriculum from 5 to 16, 1985, was vague, produced by HMI, never mentioned history. I didn't have any influence on this. And history in the primary and secondary years, which was produced in 1985, I did have a lot of influence on this, but there was opposition from some HMI, particularly on the idea of empathy, that you could get children to try and rethink the thoughts of the past, which is a Collingwood idea. And history 5 to 16, which came out later, is quite different because different HMI were then in control. And then it led to the National Curriculum Group, where I have to say I was pushed into the background. The curriculum group had a different HMI in it, who weren't quite so sympathetic to the new history. And so the orders that came out with the National Curriculum, in my view, were too overcrowded with content, as it subsequently proved, and they've had to abandon them. There was far too much content in. I've got two articles which, if you don't know of, I suggest you look at. Can I mention them?
Yes.
And then you can pick them off. Whose History? School History in the National Curriculum by Husbands and Pendry, which was published by UEA in 1992, is relevant. And a thing called History Teaching Nationhood and State, a Study in Educational Politics by Robert Phillips, is very relevant to this. The final thing I want to mention, because it's fairly private, you may not come up with it, the Teaching of History Trust, 1991-5, set up by Sir David Wills, financed discussions between Anglo-English and history, between English and history, no, Irish and English, Anglo-Irish history, university professors and inspectors from Ireland, Northern Ireland and England. R.H.C. Davis was the professor from England and I was the inspector. I can't remember all the professors from Trinity College in Belfast. Anyway, they produced some books and it shows how influenced they were by the new history. They're called Questions in Irish History. They were edited by John Rowbottom and Longman has produced them. I produced some other books, but I had to do it because of HMI, you weren't allowed to use your name. So I used the surname Woodlander, because if you know your Latin, Sylvester translates into English dweller in the woods, Woodlander. So there are a few books around called David Woodlander books on how our language grew and so on. But I just want to finalise by suggesting other contexts. If you haven't contacted Annabel Jones, I would. I think she's younger than I am. I think she was at Longman's, and she was the great, important person behind all history books that came out from Longman's, and Marjorie Reeves too. I can't help you anymore.
That's really good. Thank you for that. There were a couple of questions I wanted to ask.
Sympathy with the past. It's empathy. It's intellectual understanding of the past. And well, I thought it did get you interested. If you get interested in people in the past, well, then you get interested in them, and one way is through empathising with them. So I did think it would. Yeah.
The other thing I wanted to ask you, obviously, SCHP came along at a time when people were looking, as you said, they were looking for something different to do. A lot of history teachers were experiencing that feeling, my subject isn't valued anymore.
Mm.
I wonder if you've got any theory as to why, between the 50s and the 60s, history was less valued as a subject in the school curriculum?
I think it was a development of curriculum theory. I think you'll find there were lots of professors, certainly in the University of London, professors of curriculum theory. They were set up and curriculum development became a big thing. There were books written about curriculum development. They became professors of curriculum theory. They'd never appeared before. And they were in vogue in that period, and curriculum thinking got towards skills, and that led them towards an integrated curriculum. And a lot of the thinking went on humanities projects, integrated projects, or history, geography.
It's coming out of the American tradition.
It's coming out of the curriculum thinking of social studies.
Mm-hmm.
The social studies which came from America. And I went off on courses where we met Yes, you're quite right. All the American professors came from social studies department, but they all believed in integrated studies of some sort. And I was pleased that the sociologists now got a foot in the door. But the great thing about the sociologists, whom I was against, at least they said, no, sociology is its own subject. We can define it. I had reservations about their definition, but it made me want to say, well, we should define history too.
Do you think on the content side, people were searching for different content to the traditional syllabuses as well?
I don't think they were searching. Many of them were wedded to 19th century history. And in 19th century, British history and European. I mean, it had been my own school experience, and it is interesting. I now worry now that they do it at school, and particularly now they do the First World War at school. At O level, at GCSE, they do it for A level, and now often they go to university and that's all they do and all they ever do. I mean, I'm going to digress, man. You see, it worries me that you get some universities where you can get a BA in history, never having studied anything before 1800. That seems to me you haven't had a historical education. If you've no idea about, you know, the sources of education pre-1800, you've only looked at industrial societies, it's not a historical education. But that's a bee in my bonnet that I must lay to rest, and with that I'll stop.
Well, politicians tend to think that history should be about reinforcing, you know, loyalty, if you like, to some national ideal.
Mm.
But that obviously doesn't tie in with SCHP at all.
No, it doesn't. And you see, we had this conflict with Clark, Kenneth Clark, with our modern world studies. In 19, when did he do it? 86. He put a cap on history. If you remember, he said history in children in school must not study history after 1960 or something like that. Well, we couldn't go on studying Arab-Israeli or the Irish question if we were stopped at 1960. That was a retrograde step. But politicians rule, and I mean, my worry is they may rule so much that the curriculum becomes so vocational that subject history may get pushed out. It's becoming very instrumental at the moment. With
that was a battle you fought, and perhaps others have to fight.
Well, they may find it interesting with the battle we fought. Yes.
Thank you very much.